Yes, Ferdinand Marcos, please. Yes. Mm-hmm. President Marcos, Gene Okerlund from the World Wrestling Federation. You have upset a lot of bookies in the United States. Yes. They went the other way, quite obviously. Thank goodness you don't have anything to do with the pending slammies. No, the voting's all in. Couldn't be doctored now anyway.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Wrestling Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 73 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson. And today, we'll be taking a look at WWF All-American Wrestling for the first time in a very long time, from February 23rd, 1986, airing Sunday on the USA Network, airing clips from the various shows. We're going to get a little bit from All-Star, we're going to get a little bit from Championship Wrestling. Nothing from TNT, as I have watched the one from the week that is right after this would have aired, and there's no crossover or any of that, although we do get to see Rusty Brooks on the episode of TNT, which is episode 73 on the WWE Network, oddly enough, just kind of a fun coincidence. Let me get in my plugs real quick. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. You can follow me on Twitter at GFAllentownPod, and you're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Go to placetobenation.com to support Place to Be Nation with your Amazon purchases. Now, I was on the Place to Be podcast this past Monday discussing the Saturday Night's Main Event from April of 1988, which is a rather interesting show, with the biggest thing being that Hulk Hogan is not there, and it's the first Saturday Night's Main Event that's done entirely without him. So that show was a lot of fun to do and to talk about. As for my past weekend, I went to the beach this past weekend, and if you live near any sort of beach, you have to go at least once during the summer. Here in Massachusetts, though, there's a couple of different ones. I don't like to go to Cape Cod because the traffic to how much fun I can have at that place ratio is not good. That's why I haven't gone really to the Cape in the last 25 years of my life. There's nothing down there for me that I can't get from going to, say, a place like Salisbury Beach, which is fairly close to where I live. It's about 40 minutes, and it's just taking me back to my high school days of hanging out around there, and I didn't really remember much because it's been 21 years since I've been there, and it's just nice to walk across the beach and, you know, grab a bite to eat, get some nice seafood or whatever. I'm driving in, and at the gate where you pay for parking, it says that the water temperature, it was 54 degrees, and I'm thinking to myself, there's no way that could be correct. Like, I think that they are actively lying to the public here. And then I put my feet in the water, and it was instantly confirmed that it, in fact, was 54 degrees. It's one of the reasons why maybe I hadn't been going to the beach up here, because you can't really go in the water up here until, I don't know, much later in the summer. And I'll take a visit back there in September and see how it is at that point. But yeah, the water was plenty cold, but Salisbury Beach is nice and chill, and that's what I'm looking for, mainly. There's too many damn people going to Cape Cod, and that kind of just keeps me away from it. Went to dinner that night, and there's like this loud crowd of dudes, like, you know, at the table behind, like, where I was sitting. And they were having a good time, and it's all well and good. But if you go out and you're at dinner with like four or five of your friends, don't be that guy who talks two or three times louder than anybody else in the group. It is one of those issues that I'm very passionate about, that and clearing the snow and ice off your car before you get on the highway after a snowstorm. These are things that are very meaningful to me, and they will bear repeating as time goes along. So enough about all that. Might as well get into the background info of this show, because this particular program, All American Wrestling, and I've gone over the history of it, came on USA Network in 83 and lasted up until near the end of 1994 before it made way for Action Zone. That's not really important. You probably wonder, this show is pretty loaded with matches. We have Junkyard Dog versus Terry Funk. We have Tito Santana defending the Intercontinental title against Macho Man Randy Savage from the Boston Garden, and the Piper's Pit with Hulk Hogan. You say, that seems to be an awful lot of stuff on one program. This is a couple of big boy matches on this. So why is that? And the answer can be summed up in one word, is sweeps. It's like on the news when you see the stories that tend to be, like when they go to the Scandals and Animals format on your local news, that's how you can tell when the sweeps periods are. February, May, November, and I think there is a summer sweeps period. I forget the exact dates on that. But this kind of goes back to a very funny tweet that I saw from Monsoon Classic back on July 1st. You see, Paris Hilton had sent out a tweet that said, "Tell me something I don't know," with a picture of her just staring into the camera or whatever. And Monsoon Classic subtweeted it and said, "WWF Superstars and Wrestling Challenge typically only offered feature matches during the months of February, May, and November through the mid-1990s. And yes, that had everything to do with sweeps, and in fact, predated Superstars and Challenge, as those are still about 6 to 8 months away. We will not see them until September. So Championship Wrestling and All-Star Wrestling still on the air and having more feature matches, mainly Championship Wrestling. The difference, though, with All-American being on cable, cable did not have a sweeps period per se, but this show is along for the ride because it's airing the matches from the syndicated shows, which are part of the sweeps period. So it's kind of impacted in that way. And not only are there those feature matches on the show, we have a couple of enhancement matches with Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, the team of George Wells and Leapin' Lanny Poffo, who you might be surprised to learn they are not the enhancement talents in that case. They're facing off against somebody else who is there to make them look good. You won't believe it until you hear it. And your host for this show is Mean Gene Okerlund. And if you've watched any of these All-Americans from specifically 1986, seemed to be a year where Gene just liked to screw around and have a lot of fun because he didn't have a co-host. He didn't have to play off Lord Alfred Hayes or Hillbilly Jim as it would be in 1989. He would just kind of have to make up bits as he went along. He did a lot of silly, odd stuff like gags on the telephone, which I believe Richard Land has posted some of those on Facebook. They're these little 2-minute clips where Okerlund pretends to talk to somebody that's in like a current event. So it's one of those things where you watch the Raws from the mid-90s and they're talking about stuff that was in the news. And this is something that they like to keep it current even back then. And Okerlund makes an extremely topical reference when he does the phone gag on this show. Another thing that attracted me to this one is the commercials are left in. So original 1986 commercials that I'd be able to have some sort of commentary on as we go along. This time period is also in the lead up to WrestleMania 2, which would take place about 6 or 7 weeks after this show. And the product is still running hot at this time. After WrestleMania 2, you notice that things cool down quite a bit. Doesn't seem like there's a lot of reason to watch shows from the aftermath of WrestleMania 2 because the whole promotion felt like it was static for a minimum of 2 months after that. It's not the case beforehand because you have stuff going on in order to build to their next super show, which they hadn't had since the Wrestling Classic, I guess, would be the last super show that they would have had. But you're still in a time and age where your big shows are Madison Square Garden once a month. And I was thinking of that because they had one of their MSG shows this past Saturday night, WWE did. And they still treat that as something of a big deal, but the MSG, they don't hold pay-per-views there anymore. They only really have house shows a couple of times a year. But God forbid ROH try to run the same arena or whatever. I don't quite understand WWE pulling it. I don't get how they have an exclusivity to the building when they don't even run the building at the same level that they used to. I mean, I feel like Madison Square Garden should just take their rents from wherever, especially considering the fact that you have an arena in Brooklyn that is competing against you, and there's also going to be an arena at Belmont Park, and I don't know. It's one of those MSG things. I'm not entirely sure how I got onto that. But yes, they're building to WrestleMania 2. Which, that show, it's in three cities, of course. That's what it's most famous for. And oddly enough, Howard Finkel said it was his favorite WrestleMania ever, shortly before WrestleMania 30, which made me think that something was off kilter and that maybe we should have had given him a brain scan or something like that. And I don't mean the Bobby Heenan replay system. I mean, like, they should have actually examined him. That show is really two parts to it. A lot of people crap on it because they think of all the bad stuff and they don't really think of all the good stuff that happens after the Moolah versus Velvet McIntyre just absolute atrocity of a match that thankfully was only 2 minutes. Once you get past that point, you have the Battle Royal in Chicago, you have the Bulldogs winning the titles, the Nightmare in Chicago at the Rosemont Horizon for the Dream Team. And the whole LA card is really good with Steamboat Hercules. You get the tag match with the two Funk brothers, because we're going to be introduced to Dory Funk on this show, which is a very interesting thing because I didn't know until like a year ago how Dory Funk had been brought in. I just thought that he just showed up alongside his brother at some point in time and that there wasn't an angle, but the angle will take place on this show. And I am a fan of the Hogan-Bundy cage match, maybe more than most people. And perhaps I'm biased because Jesse Ventura is doing play-by-play on the LA portion of WrestleMania 2, which I always thought was kind of neat and made it a little bit different. And also Jesse calling the Hulk Hogan match at WrestleMania as the main play-by-play guy is just kind of fun to look back on. So as I was saying, between the ads, between all the big boy matches we have here today, there's a lot to get to, so let's just jump right into the show. Quick explanation on a change just for this week, because it's episode 73, and with that being my favorite number, I might as well just play some of my favorite songs. Like, that was Crowd Chant by Joe Satriani, a song you may have heard at sporting events. I know they play it. It's the goal song for the New York Islanders, but it was also my walk-in song at my wedding with my wife into the reception. Played this song, and it was a very thoughtful choice by me, because Joe Satriani was born in 1956 in the town where my wife grew up. So that was actually kind of an accident. I found that out later, and I retconned it back in. More on retconning something into a story later on in this show, because that'll definitely come up again. And Okerlund opens the show, but we have ads right off the bat. And one of them is for a discount perfume that is pretty much ripping off Giorgio. This one happens to be called Secret.
Then one day I came across this book called The Secret.
No, Ryback. This is the fragrance, The Secret, not the book. God, remember that storyline? I looked up what Raw that was, and it was the December 29th, 2014 Raw, which stands out in my mind for being just particularly awful, because that was the one where you had Rollins holding Edge hostage, and then Cena agrees to reinstate the authority, thereby completely undoing the entire Survivor Series storyline, which was step one in telling me that nothing matters from a storytelling perspective anymore, and that you're just willing to insult the audience. Oh, by the way, yeah, Triple H and Stephanie come back to TV after a hiatus, just as football season starts to end. I mean, I they're not stupid people, but it was just so cynical, and it made me cynical, and I should have taken a break at that point, but instead I kept watching, because on that show, Daniel Bryan declared for the 2015 Royal Rumble, and I can only assume that it turned out perfectly good. Anyway, our first match here features Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff taking on Don Koloff, and not Nikita Koloff, this is K-O-L-O-V, and he is listed from, or announced from, Bulgaria. So eat your heart out, Rusev, because it's Koloff Day back in 1986. Now, Mr. Wonderful is in the middle of his babyface run, which seems like an odd thing to some, because he did not have very many turns as a babyface. He's a heel for much of his career. And even Jesse, on the commentary towards the beginning of this match, kind of makes a subtle allusion to the fact that it does seem a little odd that he's a quote-unquote good guy.
Oh, Mr. Wonderful. See, Mr. Wonderful and I, we go back a ways. And he might be pulling one on all these people on what a nice guy he is, Gorilla, but I know the real Mr. Wonderful.
Gorilla Monsoon, his partner, has a kind of a funny retort. Says, well, we thought you knew Adrian Adonis, too. Because Adonis, the character, had just come out as gay on Tuesday Night Titans not long before this, is the start of the adorable gimmick. And Jesse and Adrian Adonis are longtime tag team partners dating back to the AWA. They teamed a little in 1982 in the WWF, although I think that team was a little bit less focused in terms of just being a unit. Make reference to Paul Orndorff being inducted into the University of Tampa Hall of Fame in 86, and I looked it up, and he actually was inducted. I said, okay, was he inducted alongside anybody else who is famous? And no, none of the six names here that were inducted are names that anybody would know, or really nothing I could even spin to make them sound interesting. But just going down the list of other notables who have been inducted into the University of Tampa Hall of Fame, I mean, this is not like the Ohio State University or one of those places where, you know, you'd know a lot of athletes or a lot of famous people had gone there. So here are a few notables. Earl Bruce, who's a football coach, oddly, coincidentally, considering I just mentioned Ohio State, he coached at Ohio State into the 80s. He coached at University of Tampa for 1 year, and they inducted him into the Hall of Fame. I thought that was a little strange. I don't know what else was going on. John Matuszak, who went on to have a pretty good NFL career with the Raiders. However, you probably know him best as the guy who played Sloth in the Goonies. And then also former New York Yankees great Sam Militello, another example of how the national media cartels, like ESPN and, you know, the New York media, when a Yankee prospect comes along, we must pump them up as much as possible. And some of them work out, like a Gleyber Torres or Derek Jeter back in the day. But Sam Militello, yeah, not so much, even though he was kind of portrayed as a god back when, sort of on that Kevin Moss level, as I recall. Vince Namoli, who I hope I'm pronouncing that right, he was the first owner of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, as they were known. And that organization was pretty chaotic for the entire time that he was running things until he finally sold. And a later manager of the Tampa Bay Rays, Lou Piniella. So if you're wondering why he would have left the jobs that he was in to go manage in Tampa, that's one of the reasons why, is it's where he went to college. Of course, he managed the Yankees, the Reds, the Cubs. I'm probably missing other teams along the way. There's also a Hall of Famer in there by the name of Ginger Lynn, but this one happens to be a soccer player, so she plays with a completely different set of balls than the other Ginger Lynn. Anyway, Paul Orndorff, he tosses Koloff down from an overhead wrist lock, and Monsoon calls him Colo, which apparently he just wasn't paying attention. And this kind of reminded me of the Nikita Koloff rumor of him going to the WWF for WrestleMania 2 to challenge Hulk Hogan, to have him in that Bundy spot. And I'm not sure, he obviously never made the jump, and I'm not sure how close that would have come to fruition or anything like that. But it is interesting when you think about how the angle with Bundy isn't put on TV until a week after this, which is March the 1st on the Saturday night's main event. So you have a five-week lead-up to the WrestleMania main event. And I think that they maybe were trying to get Koloff, you know, up until the last minute, and then, okay, we have Bundy in reserve, and we're going to go with him. I mean, that's kind of how I see it in my head as it's happening. Gorilla mentions that he wrestled in Bulgaria once. It said it's a very nice country. I'm like, okay. I do miss that kind of stuff when you have former wrestlers on both play-by-play and color, when you'd have kind of banter like that. Everything's now, in WWE in particular, is so kind of generic. I wish that you would get a little bit more color like that. Of course, Gorilla was once billed from Manchuria, so he's no stranger to, like, weird places around the globe or being associated with them. Dropped Toehold by Orndorff. Even Jesse would put over baby faces a lot more frequently in his early commentary days. And remember, he's only about a year in, because he only started, I think, in January, very beginning of January in 1985. Orndorff, and this kind of made me think, you know, when Jesse was talking about him, he's not doing very much in early 86. The Piper feud is in the rearview mirror, so he doesn't have much going on. His match at WrestleMania 2 is against the Magnificent Morocco, and it ends in a schmoz. It was either, I think it was double count out in that case, and it was only 5 minutes. And it seemed like one of those matches where you have a top five babyface and a top five heel, and we're just going to throw them against each other. And it seems like it was a battle of the pile drivers is what they were trying to get at. I mean, without having seen all the TV recently leading up to WrestleMania 2, I think that was kind of the idea of that match. What Orndorff is doing is he's still very much over with the crowd, and you could tell that he's getting a reaction in this match. It's to tread water. We're not going to have something for you like this entire time going through, although I had a few ideas that maybe, you know, maybe he could have done in terms of maybe challenging for certain titles in the meantime. But you got to leave them there so that you can do the Hulk Hogan turn in the summer with the business, because as I said, after WrestleMania 2, WWF was very, very plain and boring. There was not a lot going on until you have that Orndorff turn in the summer, and that kind of ignites things going forward. But for right now, he's just treading water, but the crowd is responding to him, and that's what counts. And the pile driver wins it for him. And Jesse is very upset because he doesn't dedicate the pile driver to him as Morocco has been doing on the television more recently. So Paul Orndorff, just as I said, just treading water right now, but that big money feud with Hulk Hogan is just a few months away.
Remember, later on during the course of this hour, more word on the Slammies, and the Slammies are coming up this Saturday night, live from Baltimore, Maryland, and that tremendous Civic Center in that great city.
Yes, the first and often forgotten Slammy Awards of 1986. Everybody knows the 87 one because of the Vince McMahon performance of Stand Back and the brawl between King Harley Race and Hacksaw Jim Duggan, where they went all around the backstage area and there's a chicken and all this other stuff. This one, I think, tends to be forgotten in part because you don't really see much of it at all, because it aired originally live on MTV that night. So the WWF had two shows going on in terms of one on MTV and then later the Saturday Night's Main Event on NBC. The thing about the 86 Slammies is that nobody really gets to see it. I seem to recall that the WWE Network at one time had posted at least the 87 Slammies and maybe some of the later editions, you know, with Owen Hart stealing the Slammy and all that sort of stuff. I don't remember seeing 86 on there when they had it posted, and that's probably chalked up to the fact that it's the weird MTV thing and who has the rights, or WWE feels like, well, we can't throw this out there because MTV maintains part of the rights. Same reason why you don't see War to Settle the Score and all that stuff in, you know, in its original form or whatever on the network. And then following the plug by Okerlund for the Slammies, we get an early version of the WWF on tour where Howard Finkel is telling us where the WWF is coming. You might remember those from primetime wrestling where the airplane would fly across the screen and it would tell us that Hacksaw Jim Duggan was coming to Altoona or something to that effect. This time it's actually a truck going across the desert, probably a little, maybe because the promotion's a little bit more disorganized and kind of all over the place. And I noticed that they're listing three places a night in a couple of times.
World Wrestling Federation on tour, coming to these great areas and facilities with action. Wednesday, March 5th, Sacramento, California, Arco Arena, George the Animal Steel Seat action in Sacramento.
Maybe someday I'll get the rhyme or reason for how they would announce certain guys with certain dates and locations, because it's never really made a whole lot of sense to me. George Steele's coming to the Arco Arena in Sacramento. Yeah, I'm going to make my way out to see that show. And by the way, courtesy of the history of WWE.com, I have that card from Sacramento, which would have been a Wednesday night. So think about that on a school night, and you want to take your kids out to this one on March 5th, 1986, at the Arco Arena in Sacramento. Here is the card, which may not be complete because there's only five matches, but tell me what you think the best one out of this is. Greg Valentine versus George Wells. George the Animal Steel, as promised, versus Adrian Adonis. Hillbilly Jim and Corporal Kirshner versus Nikolai Volkoff and the Iron Sheik. B. Brian Blair versus Brutus Beefcake. That's a lot of B's in that one. And then finally, I don't know if this was our main event, King Kong Bundy versus Uncle Elmer. Because that same night, they were running two other shows on a Wednesday in March. They certainly meant business. They go into the commercial break, and there is an ad for House.
You're risking a patient's life.
No, not that House, which was ubiquitous during the fall of 2004 on Fox and during the baseball playoffs. This is the movie House that spawned three sequels. And I have to admit, I do not remember this. I've certainly never seen it because I'm not particularly familiar with the horror genre. But the cast is pretty good in terms of dudes who played roles in memorable 1980s sitcoms. You had William Catt from The Greatest American Hero earlier in the 80s, George Wendt, of course, Norm from Cheers, and Richard Mull from Night Court. I don't care, though. I really don't want to see it. You get Bug Away. I'm always up for a bug repellent system, but this is airing in February. I really don't have much of a need for it until you get to maybe May. And then by the time September rolls around, I don't really need it anymore, at least in my area of the country. Maybe in Florida, it's more useful. And then finally, an ad for a pocket TV, which is something fairly new, I guess, and revolutionary in 1986. I actually had one of those as a kid. Who'd say, well, how the hell do you get your hand on one of those? It actually was one of those little prizes that they would give you at the end of it. So, like, my parents, they would go to this, to the stupid condo pitch thing where they would try to sell you on a condo, and they would sit through the thing for an hour, hour and a half, and then at the end, they give you a little pocket or portable TV. I had it for years, and I remember specifically watching Game 1 of the 1993 World Series on that, because obviously you have to watch whatever on network TV, and you have to get some sort of signal coming in. And I just recall coming back from, it was probably a youth hockey game, even though I was a little old at age 14, that I just remember watching Curt Schilling against the Toronto Blue Jays, and just wondering, I certainly hope this guy doesn't turn into a racist D-bag in the future.
Just when the WWF believes it knows all the answers, the rowdy one changes the questions. His latest bombshell is Boxer Bob Orton. Bob has donned the leather gloves and is running roughshod over the opposition. The challenge is out to anyone who has wrestled in the WWF.
There's going to be more on this later, the boxing and Roddy Piper and Bob Orton coming up in Piper's Pit. But the Piper, as with Orton as his proxy in the boxing ring, has always kind of struck me as a little weird in that, well, there were only two matches on record that Bob Orton had as a boxer, because it's completely pointless to do it on a house show, because that doesn't really count for any storyline purposes. That's the only reason why you'd be doing this. So they had a boxing match on television, Bob Orton versus Jose Luis Rivera. So apparently, even in boxing, there are enhancement talents. You might remember Glass Joe from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out shortly after this time frame. I want to say Tyson's Punch-Out came out in 87 or 88. So they show the clip of Orton against Rivera that had aired on Championship Wrestling a week earlier. I believe it was the February 15th edition. And you will see some of the worst technique. Now, I'm not a boxing commentator, analyst, any of that. I'm no Larry Merchant or whatever, but some of the worst technique you'll ever see, where guys with their arms down by their side just leaving themselves wide open. And the whole thing just kind of exposes the business, too, at a time where, well, it was still being protected, let's just say. And Orton throws a punch, and Rivera goes down like a ton of bricks, and it makes you wonder, why doesn't he go down during the bare-knuckle punches like that? It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. And boxing, mixed in with wrestling, and I'm not talking about those boxer versus wrestling matches that tended to be in vogue more in like the 70s, it seems, with the whole Ali thing and Buddy Wolf, which actually, that's one of the more hits than misses, because Ali versus Buddy Wolf is so hilarious just for Howard Cosell's derisive commentary of it, mixed with Buddy Wolf's just open blading on ABC TV, because it's on, you know, network television. But when you mix these two things, it just comes off as rather confusing in terms of, like, why are we doing, but it's the Brawl for All thing, where that comes up years later, and you're wondering, what exactly is the point of this? And as it turns out, I don't think anybody really knew. They just assumed that maybe a certain guy might end up winning, and then they could turn it into a story later. Well, that's not really good storytelling if you're just hoping that something will happen and then you can turn a story out of it later. More on the boxing when we get to Piper's Pit and how that would develop.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Up next, we have the unnamed team of George Wells and Leapin' Lanny Poffo, who I believe we saw in episode 62, covering WWF All-Star Wrestling from August of 1985. And they are taking on the team of Rusty Brooks, who I will forever love and appreciate his work during this time period, and Johnny Canine, who I have spoken of before. Talked about the motorcycle gang that he was associated with that was called Satan's Choice, which sounded like the worst Walmart store brand of all time. There's actually a documentary on YouTube that's about 23 minutes long on Satan's Choice and what they are. I'm a little bit frightened to watch it, quite frankly, because biker culture is one of those things that I don't necessarily get very much. I mean, I don't begrudge anybody, but I just don't really get it. I mean, I can see why you would get together because you have common interests in having a motorcycle. Some of the other gangs, because he had been affiliated with other gangs in Canada, which, by the way, are like American motorcycle gangs, except they say please and thank you 37% more of the time. Other ones are, some of the names of these are kind of funny. The Red Scorpions, the United Nations. How do you come up with names for motorcycle gangs? I get Hell's Angels. I mean, and that's a name that's pretty damn good. Other than that, I don't know how you come up with United Nations. I guess that might be, you know, some sort of alignment of different gangs. I don't quite know. And he had some murder raps over the years, which they go into detail on his pretty lengthy Wikipedia page for a guy who was an enhancement talent in the mid-80s WWF. I mean, certainly more to him. And at this point, he's in his early to mid-20s, so he had some years left. As he passed away last year at the age of 51. So, yeah, he's a very young man this time. And on the other side, George Wells, he's a former CFL player, not much of a personality, but at least with Lanny Poffo, you always had at least the one thing going for him as a babyface, which was the poetry, the poet laureate gimmick of the WWF, which is something fairly original. I mean, nobody else was doing that sort of thing, interacting with the crowd by throwing the frisbee out. However, when he would read his poems, sometimes they would come off as a little plain, a little boring. So I've taken it upon myself to perhaps, I don't know if this is the right word, jazz up what Lanny Poffo's poetry reading. Maybe make him a beat poet.
The World Wrestling Federation has caused a culture shock in every phase of our society, from classical to rock. In triumphant jubilation, every social class is one with a single common interest, just to have a little fun. I've seen the rapture in the eyes of fans from every nation. You made us what we are today. World Wrestling Federation.
So if you make Lanny Poffo a white rapper in 1986, that certainly does make him stand out even more and very different. A decade and a half before John Cena would basically ride the exact same thing to great heights. And rap was working for the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. I mean, maybe, you know, because it hadn't aired by this point, early 86, but you're coming off the Super Bowl shuffle, the Bears, as I've talked about on several occasions. Seemed like some people were ready for that sort of thing, even if it didn't come off as particularly good rap or anything. But I'm just trying to think of ways to get Lanny Poffo to that next level that took the WWF till 1989 to give him a little something as the genius, which basically just could have sort of made him into the heel version of what he is here on the same level, just on the other side of the ledger. And they start out, Poffo starts out with the rotund Rusty Brooks, with a hip toss and then a drop kick on Rusty, who they then end up in the corner. A canine gets in, and Gorilla says that he is very unorthodox indeed. Johnny Canine, just looking at him, he strikes me as, he reminds me of D-Day from Animal House, or whatever. Like he could just drive off in a police car, never to be seen again, which does make sense with his, you know, biker gang past. He drops the leg, which probably pissed off Hogan somewhere in the back, and the second one ends up missing, and Poffo then kips up, not something you were seeing a lot in that time period. And then on the outside, K9 is a springboard, and then Poffo dives to the outside. Once again, Lanny Poffo is doing stuff that would become all too commonplace years later. The problem is, he doesn't really make a whole lot of contact with K9 outside the ring. It's sort of like he took a big swing and he fouled it off, you know, just sort of, you know, down the third baseline or something like that. As I always say, there's always something a little off about Lanny Poffo, that where you feel like maybe it's all there, it's close, but it's just not connecting the same way. He tags out to Wells, and at this point I notice down the leg of his tights that I always say look like kind of football pants, but a little bit longer version of that. It says Master G on there, which was his nickname in wrestling earlier, so it's not a reference to the guy from the Sugar Hill Gang. Although, you know, if he had become a rapper too alongside Poffo, that might have been an interesting gimmick to maybe put this team over the top. Maybe they could have been the Too Cool of the mid-80s. Who knows? I mean, there are definite worse ideas. He ends up in trouble on the other side of the ring as well. And Brooks is working him over. I just love the stars on Rusty Brooks' gear. They just scream 1980s wrestling to me, and I have great appreciation for that. But Wells gets out of there. He tags out to Lanny, and he's got Fist of Fury on the mat, and then a standing drop kick on Johnny K9. Wells back in, vertical suplex, before he tags back out to Poffo again, who hits a somersault senton, like yet another move that you don't see a lot of in 86, but Poffo is doing it here, and it is fairly well executed. And then he does a cradle-type maneuver. I don't quite understand what he was trying to accomplish, because he wasn't rolling it into a pinning combination. Potentially it was a mistake, but I don't really care. All four guys end up in the ring. Brooks gets escorted out. It was only briefly, and Brooks gets escorted out of the ring. A shoulder block by Wells on Johnny K9 picks up the win. On the graphic before the match, they referred to Johnny K9 as John K9, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And when you say it, John K9 doesn't sound as good as Johnny K9. Not sure why they would do it that way. It's kind of like that thing when I'm a huge fan of David Crosby's music, but also David Crosby Twitter, and one of the common questions that he gets is, how come you guys named the band Crosby, Stills, and Nash? And his answer is, try saying it any other way. Stills, Nash, and Crosby. Stills, Crosby, and Nash. Nash, Stills, and Crosby. It doesn't work. It flows the best as Crosby, Stills, and Nash, just like Johnny K9 flows better than John K9. Poffo does a backflip to celebrate the victory, but he does it in kind of a gymnastic sort of way. He doesn't, like, leave his feet or anything. It's always like something is touching the ring as he does it. It almost looks like a cartwheel of sorts. I don't know, but I'm just trying to think of ways for Wells and Poffo how this could have developed, which is ridiculous that I'm wasting my time thinking about George Wells from the 1980s, and I'm thinking, if you make Poffo a rapper and you have him go down that road, what you do is you have Wells turn heel on him at some point, talking about cultural appropriation, all that sort of stuff. Or maybe even just say that he's jealous of the moves that Poffo would do, like the, you know, dive to the outside that barely makes contact. It's not quite there with the crowd, this team, which is why you wouldn't be seeing Wells too much longer after WrestleMania 2, when he would lose to Jake the Snake Roberts and would be foaming at the mouth, literally.
WrestleMania 2, man, it's coming up right around the corner, and even though I won't be able to deliver the winning blow with my cast, because Paul Orndorff outsmarted me, had the cast taken off while my poor arm is still hurting, now I'll be in WrestleMania because I am one of the premier wrestlers in the World Wrestling Federation, a superstar, one of the greatest you'd ever want to see, but more than likely, I'll be in boxing gloves.
Not great, Bob.
Yeah, Orton was a little off the mark there, because he would end up in Roddy Piper's corner for his boxing match, which is going to get set up on Piper's Pit later in the program, and it does make some manner of sense for Orton to be in that role, as he is one of the great stooges in wrestling history as a background character, something that they would carry later on into the Flower Shop versus Piper's Pit feud when Piper goes on hiatus and Orton is wearing the pink cowboy hat that Piper sees when he returns. I covered this all the way back in episode 1. If you want to check out my prehistoric episodes where I'm talking in more of a professorial manner and something that really would not have held up for the long term, I don't think. And the WrestleMania 2 thing, it was not the worst WrestleMania match that an Orton would be involved in, because I've seen Randy Orton versus Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania 33, so that's, you know, you can't really sink too much lower than that, I don't think. Orton's cast, which he makes reference to in this interview, that Paul Orndorff had gotten it off of him, or for some reason he can't wear it anymore. That's an example in wrestling, I think, of the, quote, Mandela effect, which is a psychological condition where groups of people remember something as happening, but it didn't actually happen. And it's named the Mandela effect because there are groups of people who had believed that Nelson Mandela had died in prison in the 1980s, before he would have been released in 1990. But of course, that didn't happen. It's a false memory based on information that you've processed in your head. And with the Orton cast thing, it's that I remember him wearing it from the second he got there to the second he left, but that's not how it went. But the reason why I would remember that is when you see the footage of Orton, it's almost all centered around WrestleMania 1, because he's part of the main event. He's the corner man for the heels, and that cast plays a role in the finish of the match, too. So it kind of has this outsized whatever in my head in terms of remembering it. And here we are, early 86. He's still got a year and a half before he leaves the WWF, and it's already off him. I watched the Hogan versus Orton match from May of 87 on Superstars, and it is not there as well. So, yeah, just a false memory on my part, and probably many others as well. And then there is an advertisement for the upcoming WrestleMania 2.
It only happens once a year. WrestleMania 2.
I know that voice, but I don't know who that guy is. I think it's the same guy who a year later would do those Survivor Series promos that were so ominous.
Thanksgiving night. Witness the Survivor Series.
Would have been funny if the way Jim Crockett had found out that the Survivor Series was going to detract from Starrcade coming to pay-per-view is them just leaving that recording on Jim Crockett's answering machine, or whatever would have passed for voicemail in 1987. Anyway, they go into an ad break again. We get the shorter version of the Giorgio perfume ad, and then an ad for Old Spice cologne. And I'm wondering, what the hell is going on this program with all the fragrance ads? Apparently, apparently in the mid-80s, people just wanted to smell better than they actually were and were just going to douse themselves. I mean, Axe body spray would be the answer to it years later. By the way, my wife gets in my car the other day. I had this Black Ice air freshener that's pretty much used up by now. She's like, your car smells like Axe body spray. I'm like, I have no idea what that even smells like because I have never purchased, nor will I ever purchase, Axe body spray. But enough of the fragrance ads. We get into something that all of us can enjoy, an actual wrestling product that I never owned, WWF Thumb Wrestlers.
No matter where you are, with Thumb Wrestlers, it's just like being in a wrestling ring. With Hulk Hogan and Rowdy Roddy Piper.
One, two, three, pin!
Wherever you are, it's like real wrestling action. With Junkyard Dog and Volkoff. Thumb Wrestle Anywhere with Hulk and the Iron Sheik.
Okay, kids, back to class.
Wrestle Anywhere with wrestling superstars Thumb Wrestlers, new from LJN.
Yeah, I never had any of those, probably because I didn't need them because I had the regular LJN figures, which, as I've mentioned many times, that I still have to this day. But why would I not need the Thumb Wrestlers? I remember doing that in school, but personally, I don't like to do a lot of bragging on this podcast. I'm a little bit more modest, maybe even more modest than I should be, but when it comes to thumb wrestling, okay, and maybe I shouldn't say this, because I am retired from the game. I was like the Andre the Giant of the thumb wrestling community. I was really good at it, and I've been credited because of my giant freak thumbs that perhaps, you know, that comparison to Andre, you know, that certainly comes into play. But I would go around to the various territories in the schoolyard and settle beefs, you know, from a thumb wrestling perspective with my thumbs, you know, another thing that Andre would sort of do. And I went 15 years undefeated in thumb wrestling. So the Andre comparison is 100% apt. Apt, I tell you.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Bad Boys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows plus others available at PlaceForNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and historyofwrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceForNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yes, Ferdinand Marcos, please. Yes. Mm-hmm. President Marcos, Gene Okerlund from the World Wrestling Federation. You have upset a lot of bookies in the United States. Yes. They went the other way, quite obviously. Thank goodness you don't have anything to do with the pending slammies. No, the voting's all in. Couldn't be doctored now anyway. Very good. Thank you. Ferdinand Marcos, a very dear close personal longtime friend of mine, continues to reign supreme in the Philippines.
I don't get the reference to bookies that Okerlund is making, but I do understand why he's calling Ferdinand Marcos, because it is in that week in 1986. This is during the election that Marcos had called in late 85, called a snap election because they were turning it around. He called for it in November, and the election was held in early February of 86, where his main opponent was Corazon Aquino, the widow of a deceased rival, political rival of Marcos. And you're wondering, how the hell can you tie this back to wrestling in some way? The name of this revolution, this uprising against Marcos, was called the People Power Revolution, which has nothing to do with John Laurinaitis. Thank God. Gotta vote for democracy. Whatever. I mean, so what happened was there was manipulation of the election results earlier in February by Marcos' side, as you might expect from a guy who had been a dictator in office for two decades. And long story short, this led to 4 days of protests culminating February 22nd to the 25th. So it is going on the day that this show airs. And eventually, the way it ended was Marcos kind of stood down against popular opposition. I mean, 500,000 people were in the streets when he ordered them not to shoot on the protesters. And I don't mean in a wrestling sense. I mean with guns. And eventually, he did leave the country. Although, most people just tend to remember his wife, Imelda Marcos, and the fact that she owned like 10,000 pairs of shoes, however it was. And Corazon Aquino, she took the oath of office, and democracy was put in place somewhat peacefully in the Philippines, kind of providing a guide for Eastern Europe in the years to come. So, something, you know, kind of important. Okerlund, his close personal longtime friend, Ferdinand Marcos, might be one of the best examples of the absurdity of him just talking about that. Sometimes forgotten how in the mid-90s, Collective Soul was briefly thought of as a one-hit wonder band for Shine off Hints, Allegations, and Things Left Unsaid. And they didn't have a follow-up until a few years later when you had the album Collective Soul came out with December and Gel and The World I Know. And I really think they're one of the most underrated bands of the 90s. And I wish they'd come around my area so that I can see them live. I don't think they've been up here in about 7 or 8 years, or at least where I've been in a position to go to a show. I know that they did a show in New Hampshire, and I couldn't go because I was hosting a party at my house, and I was unable to convince people to leave my house to go see Collective Soul with me. But yeah, certainly one of my favorite bands of that time period and all the way to today. And another one of my all-time favorites, Terry Funk, is up next, taking on the Junkyard Dog. This is originally aired on Championship Wrestling February 15th. And this feud felt like it went on and on and on, pretty much from the moment Terry Funk came in. And in fact, it started with his debut match when he abused Mel Phillips, and rightfully so, because Mel decided to put Terry's hat on instead of just carrying it over along with all the other accessories. So really just a long feud with the Junkyard Dog. And he talks about that in his book, Terry Funk, More Than Just Hardcore. So I'll read a little bit of it here. Most of my early matches in the WWF, however, were part of my feud with Sylvester Ritter, the Junkyard Dog. On my debut, they had me attack black ring announcer Mel Phillips to set up my feud with Junkyard Dog, a black superhero of sorts. The Phillips deal and the ensuing feud had some racial overtones. I've never been a prejudiced person, but I didn't have any qualms about the racial angle. Believe me, I have been on the receiving end of prejudice. I know what it's like to not get the fair shake. Then he kind of goes on about how in Japan, the Japanese wrestlers are treated better than the American Gaijin, which I understand and I hear his point there, but to compare it with the African-American experience in the United States, I think is a little misguided, and probably you could put it a different way. Later goes on, my series with JYD did some good business. At the time, there was an A crew and a B crew, with Hogan always heading the A shows. JYD and I were the main event for the B shows, and we held our own. And yeah, actually, there was three sets of shows, as I've pointed out when they were talking about the WWF on tour. I was trying to think of some alternate feuds for Terry Funk. The most logical one that I think of right away is perhaps Tito Santana, because he was the Intercontinental Champion for the time shortly after Funk had come in and into the fall and winter. Paul Orndorff is certainly another guy, because I had just talked about how he had really nothing going on, and a feud with Terry Funk would have led to some nice brawls in the spirit and style of what Orndorff was having with Piper. You would have had to find something to really ignite that issue, but I'm sure with two guys of their abilities that maybe I don't think you would have had much of a problem coming up with something, or perhaps a longer Hogan Terry Funk feud, since I so enjoyed their Saturday Night's Main Event match that I covered all the way back in, I want to say it was episode 28 or 29, Saturday Night's Main Event from January of 1986. As JYD comes to the ring, and his music here, he is now officially off Another One Bites the Dust by Queen, and now on to his own song from the wrestling album, Grab Them Cakes, for which he would win Best Solo Performance at the 1986 Slammies the following week. He gets attacked right away by Funk as he is entering the ring, and they spill to the outside for a little bit, and then a backdrop and a slam by the Junkyard Dog, which he then follows up with the on all fours headbutts that JYD was famous for. And Terry, he falls out of the ring, but then he gets back in. He starts shuffling like a boxer, like he's like apparently the spirit of Bob Orton compels him. But he's caught with a right hand by Junkyard Dog, and then his head is thrown into the turnbuckle 10 times, much to the delight of the crowd in Poughkeepsie, New York, on that afternoon or evening. He kind of staggers across to the opposite corner, so JYD figures, well, why don't I just do this again? He rams his head 10 times into the turnbuckle there, and Funk staggers a little bit like a drunk man over to another corner, and then a third time, but when he gets to about 4 or 5, Jimmy Hart on the outside grabs the leg of JYD, who then jumps out of the ring and chases Jimmy Hart around the ring. And this is actually a very good test for the Mouth of the South to see in what kind of shape he's in. Not that you could ever have issues outrunning the Junkyard Dog. I think it's from the perspective of, if you're running and Junkyard Dog in 1986 catches up to you, you better take a long look in the freaking mirror, because that just shows just horribly out of shape you are. You'd have to smoke, like, I think, 3 packs of cigarettes a day in order to put yourself in the kind of condition where the Junkyard Dog is catching up to you in a foot race. So he scurries around the ring, and then he cuts through the middle of the ring. And Jimmy Hart is very fast at moving across that ring on all fours. Gotta give him a great deal of credit there. And JYD actually gets his attention back to Terry Funk, scores with a clothesline, that gets a 2 count. The Dog follows up with a headbutt, and Terry falls back into the ropes and does the Andre the Giant spot, where he ends up tied up. At this point, Jimmy Hart has come into the ring with the branding iron and gets caught with it, and they do a little do-si-do where Jimmy Hart is spun around and then he is sent face first into the corner. So now JYD has the branding iron, but in the background, as he's about to brand Terry Funk, who is helplessly tied in the ropes, which it kind of feels a little bullying by JYD, but that's neither here nor there. You see a man roll into the ring wearing a suit, who then takes off his boot and hits Junkyard Dog in the back of the head with it. And so it was the debut of Dory Funk.
Wait a minute. What? Oh, no. That's Dory Funk. Isn't that?
That is Dory Funk. That is Terry Funk's brother. For goodness sakes, where'd he come from? That is definitely Dory Funk, Terry Funk's brother.
Some water in there.
It's common to talk about how surreal it is to see certain guys turn up in the WWF or WWE, you know, through the years. Thinking of Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard in 1988. It's certainly interesting seeing them there. Dusty Rhodes the following year. Flash forward even to 2014 at that Survivor Series where you do see Sting make his first appearance in WWE and then finally in the ring at that abortion that was called WrestleMania 31 the following year. All very surreal. And I think that this, with Dory Funk, notice how Vince leaves off the junior, because we can't call anybody junior, even though there was a guy named Dory Funk Sr. who was known as Dory Funk. But to see Dory Funk, the NWA World Heavyweight Champion from 1969 through 1973. So here's a guy who was the competing world champion during the end of Bruno's first reign as the Worldwide Wrestling Federation champion. And of course, the WWWF rejoined the NWA in 1971 after Bruno had lost the title. So in a way, you could say that Dory Funk was a champion of this promotion. It's just really strange. You're coming off this rock and wrestling connection that you established in the middle of 1984. Go through that year into 85. You have the Cyndi Lauper stuff, all that, all the way up to the Slammies on MTV in March 1st of 86. And here's Dory Funk, who pretty much epitomizes the exact opposite of all of that, but yet somehow it makes a great deal of sense that he comes in and tags with his brother, because looking for alternate feuds for Terry Funk, and if he did stick around for a longer period of time after WrestleMania 2, because he does do a Saturday Night's Main Event match with him and his brother against Hogan and Junkyard Dog, a feud between the Funk brothers and the British Bulldogs to kick off their title reign would have been nothing short of tremendous, because, you know, Terry Funk, I consider the greatest of all time, and him having his brother there, longtime partners, and all over the world, those matches would have been great, and they would have been great opponents for the British Bulldog. Somebody tossed a drink into the ring. You don't think of these WWF crowds as being that way, where they're throwing stuff, but somebody threw a pretty full drink into the ring as Dory Funk had come in, and they're doing their business to JYD as each of the Funks grab an arm, because it's time for Jimmy Hart to get in his shots, which was really strange because Jimmy just sort of takes off his shirt but leaves his tie there. His the Mouth of the South, he would always do things for comic effect, and he knew exactly what he was. He knew the right kind of underwear that he should wear to elicit the laughter when he would get his pants taken or whatever. He does a double stomp on the Dog, which is kind of funny because the guy is so light. I don't even think you could drop balloons on JYD, and I think it would weigh more than what Jimmy Hart does. And then he gets down and starts throwing haymakers, but they are literally the lightest punches you have ever seen in a professional wrestling ring. But, you know, it's more for the visual of the two Funk brothers there holding JYD down and introducing Dory the way that they did, which, as I said, is not exactly something that was played up in the future, because Terry was going to leave and then Dory is stuck there. He's not going to be a single wrestler in the WWF of that time period. That just wouldn't have been a fit. But as a tag team wrestler, you throw him there with Jimmy Jack Funk, and you're just left scratching your head. By the way, Jimmy is the name of Dory Funk's first wife, and they actually divorced in 1983. So just another weird thing to chew on, as you see the former NWA champion of 4 years teaming with Jesse Barr under a Lone Ranger mask, pretending to be one of the true Funks. But I love it when you see these guys, like the examples that I name, maybe not Sting at WrestleMania 31, but where you see them in situations where you don't expect to see these guys who made their name in the NWA and the territories, and to see them in the WWF and on a national level in 1996. And I had no real problem with them calling him Haas Funk, because Dory is kind of a weird name. I mean, nowadays when you hear that name, you're thinking of, you know, Finding Dory or whatever the kids' cartoon was. Besides, when I hear the name Haas, I just think of a Texan. I think of big old Dan Blocker from Bonanza, and nothing wrong with that by me. So to bring him in for this little run, they had one of the best matches on WrestleMania 2. Dory Funk Jr., just seeing him here, just, it's weird, but something feels right about it.
And that, of course, the best cut from this album, the wrestling album. The nominees, Junkyard Dog, Rowdy Roddy Piper, Captain Lou Albano, that disgusting and repulsive Nikolai Volkoff. And then, of course, yours truly. That's why I call Ferdinand Marcos today.
In an interesting coincidence, given what was happening to Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, the winner of the 1986 Kentucky Derby was actually named Ferdinand, who won from the number one spot under Bill Shoemaker, winning his final Kentucky Derby. Ferdinand would then go on and win the 1987 Breeders' Cup Classic by a nose over Ali Sheba. And don't read anything further about Ferdinand and his final fate, because it's one of the saddest things, not only in horse racing, but in all of sports. So I'm just going to leave it at that. They go to commercial, and we get an ad for the Survivor knife. And they do one of those bullcrap things where they say, order within 1 hour and get a free sportsman's knife. And even when I was a kid, I was like, now how do they know? Do they have like a clock in the call center that says, all right, and if you call, like, is it when the call comes in? Like, these are the kind of questions I would ask myself when I was a kid. And like why do you have the need for multiple knives?
This man's appendix is about to burst. Luckily, I have my trusty pocket knife. Stand back!
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert.
Don't thank me. Thank the knife.
Oh, seems like everywhere I look, people are enjoying knives.
I guess if you really want to cut out somebody's appendix for whatever reason, one of those knives might do the trick. Kind of reminds me, my friend Merrill on his 21st birthday was really angry and at my friend Jeff for not coming out drinking with us, and said that he was lollygagging and basically spent the entire night ripping on him. And then as it turns out, the next day we found out he had to go to the hospital because he had to get his appendix out. Just, you know, one of those things, I guess. There's an ad for the Commodore Plus 4, which reminded me, I don't think I got a computer in my house until 1987, and even then it was an Apple II GS, which, as far as computers go, I think it was a step up from the Commodore, because you had those the floppy disk with the big circle in the middle, like, you know, you could almost like put your hand through or whatever. A lot of good games. I played a lot of Family Feud and Jeopardy on the Apple II GS back in the day.
Retailers originally sold the Commodore Plus 4 for $299.95. Now it's yours for only $99.95 complete.
And with good reason why the price was cut so heavily. Number one, they were in a price war with other companies. And number two, probably more importantly, the line of the Commodore Plus 4 had been discontinued in 1985. So they're just trying to sell these damn things. And it was pretty much a bust in the United States, where it was derisively called, apparently, the minus 60 instead of the plus 4 by people who did not like it. Back to Okerlund, who is holding up a Lou Albano puzzle that they, I guess, were selling in various stores, and says that there are a few pieces missing, so ha ha ha. And they throw it to the Piper's Pit, where there is an open contract for Boxing Bob Orton, and Piper is mouthing off, and you hear the crowd start to go crazy in the middle of what Piper is saying, so you can tell, because Piper is still a strong heel at this time, that something else is going on, and you see Hulk Hogan emerge from the left of the screen.
You know something, Roddy Piper? I would love to climb in the ring with Boxing Bob Orton. You don't know. You just don't know how much I'd love to box his ears in. But you know something? You've got an open contract, man, and I've got a very good friend who made me make one promise. He said, Hulkster, no matter what you do,
Wait, you have a friend, man?
Yeah, I got a very good friend, something you don't know much about.
The way the challenge was issued by Piper and Orton was the open contract to anybody who had wrestled in the WWF before. So when you put it in that phrasing, you think, okay, well, who is an active wrestler now? Who was an active wrestler in the past that might come back to do this? You wouldn't necessarily think of Mr. T as being that guy. But so it was at the celebrity-filled WrestleMania 2, which featured about 34 different celebrities, from Mr. T on down to Joan Rivers, on down to Russ Francis, on down to Herb from Burger King. So it fits right in to bring him back for another run. It's just kind of interesting how he is brought back in this manner.
Anybody that wants to box Boxing Bob can box it. You can sign. I don't give a damn whose name you put on there. You sign it, he'll fight him. Mr. T!
I pity you, fool.
No, wait. The contract was not open. The contract, you know, wait.
So why did the WWF go back to Mr. T for a second go-round of WrestleMania 2? Of course, before this, he's going to have the match with Bob Orton at the Saturday night's main event that's going to end in a schmoz disqualification for a boxing match and lead into the Piper versus Mr. T match at the WrestleMania show, main eventing the first third at the Nassau Coliseum. The first reason, obviously, is because he headlines the first WrestleMania, which was a big success, and catapulted everything forward according to Vince McMahon's vision. The fact is, he's still a big star, but it is kind of surprising at the same time, given that behind the scenes, he may have caused a few problems in a few ways. Maybe not the greatest guy in the world to work with. But yeah, okay, so you're working with a true bona fide Hollywood star, sometimes an A-lister, can be rather difficult. And Mr. T was that for a period of time in the 1980s. But there's some facts here. Things had changed since the spring of 85. And Mr. T, if you'll notice the way the crowd reacted to him, seemed to me to be a little bit more muted than before. One of the reasons for that is T is not there on set. So it's Hulk Hogan signing this contract for him. And by the way, I was unaware that Hulk Hogan had power of attorney over Mr. T, where he could just sign his name to contracts and it would be legally binding. But okay, we'll put that aside. But the fact is that Mr. T's star power had definitely declined. I'm sorry, I hate to say it. Steve Bennett is not going to want to hear this. As the foremost fan of the A-Team and my Adams Division podcast partner, the show, the A-Team, had fallen out of the top 10, where it had resided for the first three seasons of its run. In its first season, it was number 10 in the ratings. 83-84, its second season, it was fourth. And then 84, 85, it was number six. But by the time you get to the fourth season, in 85, 86, which is this point in time right here, it had fallen all the way down to number 30. And then the following season, in 86, 87, it's not even in the top 30 as it wraps up its run. So the bloom is starting to come off the rose of Mr. T. And if you think that just that data there, you know, the fall of the A-team's popularity after a period of time, that match at WrestleMania, which featured in 1986 a heel being openly cheered, and Mr. T maybe not being openly booed, but let's just say that the Nassau Coliseum crowd was not exactly behind him. And I think part of that was, in the build to this, Mr. T was not quite as committed, I don't think, to the entire process of building up to the big show as he was for the first WrestleMania. There, on YouTube somewhere, I know I had watched this recently, was the last episode of Championship Wrestling before the first WrestleMania, so it would have been March 30th, 85. That's something that I'm definitely going to do in the future, because you see him on TV more frequently, not unlike Cyndi Lauper in 1984, as I had covered back in episode 22. So Mr. T, there were a lot of problems there, and they had, as Vince McMahon often does, a sort of misplaced loyalty to the guy who had made him money in the past without considering that he was certainly going to get diminished returns the next time around.
Thursday, March 6th, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the Centroplex, the Junkyard Dog seeing action in Baton Rouge.
Okay, now that one makes sense. But that might be the exception that proves the rule, because I don't remember hearing a lot of those in that manner where it struck me immediately, like, yes, you would want to promote that the Junkyard Dog is coming back to Louisiana, something of a homecoming for him where he was the biggest star earlier in the 1980s. Next, we have an ad for the WWF magazine, which I found rather fascinating.
Now on sale at your local newsstand, the latest edition of the number one selling wrestling magazine in the world. See Hope rally around the flag as the superpowers clash. SD Jones dances into our hearts. The Dog takes it all in the wrestling classic. Cyndi Lauper and the Captain battle against MS. Adonis, Jimmy's latest heart stopper. Rick McGraw remembers. Hillbilly Jim, he's peaceful and so provoked. Hogan and Tease team up again. See all this and much more in the latest edition of the WWF magazine on sale now.
I want that magazine, and I want that magazine for one thing.
SD Jones dances into our hearts.
Well, I find it hard to believe that Vince McMahon would have a black man dancing for his own amusement. I mean, that doesn't sound like him in the least. SD, it was around this time period where he had done the kayfabe hometown move from Philadelphia back to Antigua. He had a Tuesday Night Titans appearance around this time where he gets to talk about stuff like that. You can get an ad for Dream Away Weight Loss Pills. Now, weight loss pills are always kind of a giant scam, and you still see that sort of stuff on TV even to this day. But this Dream Away stuff, and just kind of looking into it, and I found a New York Times article, because they got into a lot of trouble for this sort of thing, and these sort of diet pills. In fact, they were banned from the post office at one point, to the point where they had to switch to UPS as their carrier, their delivery carrier. Newspapers and here's from the New York Times article. Newspapers and independent television stations, however, ran the advertisements for the Dream Away diet pills for many months. When officials of the Postal Service examined the pills last year, they found that consumers had been paying $19.95 for a 21-day supply of amino acids that caused no weight loss. As I said, it was banned from the mails, but then they switched to UPS. The FTC, Federal Trade Commission, obtained a preliminary court injunction forcing the diet products principals to stop making the claims. The court order also froze their assets in case courts decide to reimburse consumers. So, yeah, just stay away from diet pills, you know, exercise and good eating, good diet. You know, that sort of thing is always a lot better for you in the long run. And USA Network, of course, airing All-American Wrestling, also aired college basketball at this time frame. People forget, now, USA is a little moribund the last few years or so, because they don't have much in the way of original programming anymore. But they used to air stuff like NHL hockey in the 80s, college football, which I think I've read ads for upcoming college football games from USA. I think I might have done that in an earlier show. But here, with it being February, you're getting close to March Madness. So you had a series of college basketball games on, such as DePaul versus Notre Dame, a game in which Notre Dame won 70-59. However, DePaul ended up getting the last laugh in that whole deal, because Notre Dame lost in the first round as a 3 seed to Little Rock. I'm not sure if it was University of Arkansas Little Rock or just Little Rock, whereas DePaul made it to the Sweet 16 as a 12 seed, led by guard Rod Strickland, who would go on to become a star with the Portland Trail Blazers later on. Also a game between Boston College and Georgetown. Georgetown, this is the first year post Patrick Ewing, having gone to the NCAA finals the previous 4 years in a row. Each year Ewing was there, they had made the NCAA finals and only won the one national title in 1984. They beat the Dano Barros-led BC Eagles 90-76 on this week in 1986. And then finally, Kentucky, a national power most years, and 86 was no exception, playing Tennessee, a SEC rival, and they did prevail. Kentucky did, by a score of 62-60. Kenny Walker was the Skywalker, was the leader of the Kentucky Wildcats at that time, who lost in the NCAA regional final to one of the early examples of a Cinderella in the modern NCAA tournament, the 11 seed Louisiana State Tigers.
My very dear, close, personal, longtime friend Dick Ebersol has more than a passing interest in the World Wrestling Federation Superstar Action Dolls. This is Nikolai Volkov. Dick Ebersol, by the way, married to Susan St. James, lovely star of Kate and Allie. You knew that, right, Kevin? What is it with the hats here? Just a second. I don't know if that... Something's not right. Oh, hold it. Here we go. Nikolai Volkov hat and Hillbilly Jim hat.
Till hearing that, I completely forgot there were certain accessories with some of the... some of the LJN figures, like Hillbilly Jim with a hat, like it's a Malibu Stacy. Nikolai Volkov, I didn't even remember it had the little Russian rat hat for him. But the thing about my Volkov figure that I have now, I'm reminded of doing this, and I can't remember why I did it, is that half of one of his feet are missing, which I'm pretty sure I did as a red hot angle in my territory, where his toes on one foot were amputated off. Apparently, I was very hard on the heels as a booker. I don't know what the hell I was doing as a child, quite frankly.
Let's go to Boston, Massachusetts, the Boston Garden, for the Intercontinental title bout we've talked about.
This is a match that you've definitely seen before if you've watched any Coliseum home videos, because I think it's on 4 or 5 of them. Just thinking about the Old Garden, which is built in 1928 by a man by the name of Tex Rickard, who also built what was, the, I believe, the third Madison Square Garden around that time, the one that ended up closing in 1968. Originally designed for boxing, so it would have good enough views for wrestling. I only went to one show there in 1991, and I kind of wish I had gone to more, but by the time the building closed and they had their last house show there in May of 95, I was only 16, so it's not like I was going into the city by myself a lot in those years. But I was also glad that I was old enough to appreciate it and to want to go there to sit in as many different places as I could. As I sat in the second balcony for a Bruins game at one point, and they... renovations in the 1980s kind of killed off much of the second balcony because it was replaced by luxury boxes, so you only had that balcony remaining in the corners for Celtics games, particularly, it felt like you were hanging over the court almost. But there was a lot of crappy seats as well, where you could only see half of the ice rink or half of the court. Just really obstructed views. But you could still see the center where you would have a boxing ring or a wrestling ring. I actually did go to one boxing show there where I won tickets off the radio, unsurprisingly, answering a trivia question. And I think that was in 94. There was the middleweight boxer Dana Rosenblatt, who I had an interest in because he had graduated from the same high school I was going to at the time. And this one is Joint in Progress and was taped a couple of weeks before on Saturday, February the 8th. It's on the network, the entire show. You have Gorilla and Jesse. So this is not one of those weird house shows where you're getting Roger Kent and Lord Alfred Hayes or one of those weird combos. You're getting an A pay-per-view quality team. And Savage going over to win the Intercontinental title in fairly memorable fashion. And Danny Davis is our referee. Very conspicuous, not for the reasons that, you know, you would see him later. He's not quite evil, but he certainly looks a little weird because he's wearing khaki pants and white shoes. He's also way too demonstrative during this match, during the breaking of holds, but not in a way where you say, oh, well, that guy is favoring Savage or favoring one guy over the other. He's just a guy that's dressed weird and to the point where you start to question, well, what the hell is this guy doing as a referee? Tito and Savage would end up being a pretty solid feud through 1986. I think they had some matches at MSG, I recall hearing about on the Place to Be podcast, and Savage kicking off what would be the second longest Intercontinental title run, later passed by the Honky Tonk Man. And said this is Joint in Progress. You get a clothesline by Randy Savage for a close two count right off the bat. Double axe handle also gets two, and Tito ends up outside where Savage does the big money spot where he goes off the top to the outside. But then again, that's a real dangerous spot because every time Savage would do that, it would kill his knees, especially in a place like the Garden where they did not have the blue pads on the outside. It was just the yellow plywood. But as they get back onto the apron, Tito fires up again, elbow to the top of the head, and goes for a pin inside, and Savage ends up getting his foot on the ropes. And this is something that I had put on Facebook and on Twitter, where it says, title match Joint in Progress from the Boston Gardens. And there's a couple of weird things about that. First of all, it's that Boston Gardens thing, the Wahoo McDaniels disease that drives me absolutely insane. Also, somebody else pointed out that each of the words is capitalized, like the first letter is capitalized, kind of like those Trump tweets where he like, oh, I'm trying to emphasize one word or whatever. Well, if you're capitalizing every word, it's nothing's really being emphasized there. Tito runs into a knee in the corner on a charge, and the crowd dynamic here is interesting because they kind of pop. They're popping a little bit for Savage, who always had this little, I don't want to say cool heel, but there's a certain undercurrent of his popularity where you could definitely see that if they turned him to the other side, he was going to be kind of a big deal. When we have a kick out, Davis gets landed on, which is kind of interesting, and then Tito goes for a small package, but this is not a true ref bump as he is just delayed, and Davis gets a two count on a small package by Tito. So if you're going to retcon this in a way where, oh, Davis screwed Tito Santana, you look at that, he got hit, he was delayed coming over for, you know, what ended up being kind of a visual pinfall. Savage misses on a knee drop, and Tito goes right to work on that leg, because remember, the figure four was a heavy move in his move set during this time. Owing back to his feud with Greg Valentine, he puts on the figure four, and Savage is fighting it for a good while and he's in the center of the ring, but eventually he rolls to his right and barely gets to the ropes, and he ends up on the apron, and he starts fiddling for something, but you can't see it because he's opposite hard camera, so he's facing the aisleway. The aisleway in the old garden would be straight ahead, kind of like what you'd be familiar with from watching shows at Madison Square Garden. Tito then suplexes him a vertical back in and goes for the figure four again, but he is kicked off by Savage, who then slithers out to the apron. And now he goes into his tights, and this is a memorable image because Savage kind of goes a little too uncomfortably deep into his tights. Like, it looks like he's actually going to whip it out and do the first Joey Ryan spot that's ever been done. But instead, he pulls out what looks to be a metal bar of some kind. And when Tito comes over to him, he takes a swing and misses. And this looked a little bit clumsy, but I'm going to chalk it up to the fact that this is very late in the match and the guys are tired. It takes them a little bit to set up for the back suplex maneuver, the belly to back. And as Savage is being picked up, as he's at the midpoint, he slugs Tito with his right hand, knocking him out cold, and goes for the pin, and it's a 1-2-3. And again, you can hear a little bit of a crowd pop for the heel Macho Man. Let's say you can notice some changes in WWF crowds in 1986. Not necessarily that they're cheering heels, but you have Savage here, you have Piper at WrestleMania 2, and a lot more boring chants, which granted, you know, some of those MSG matches that they have, you know, couldn't really help yourself, but it's I did notice something of a change when you watch footage from that year. Savage slyly rolls the object out of the ring, and you just think about this. The next Intercontinental title change that you'd see, this is February of 86, won't be until WrestleMania 3. And think about all the changes that will take place between now and then. And basically, that is the shot where the WWF says, okay, we are now the unchallenged number one because we drew this large, unthinkable crowd to this dome stadium. And I do also like how, if this was the AWA, they probably would hold up the title in some nonsensical fashion for a couple of weeks. But they didn't do this. They just had a heel straight-up cheat to win the title, which is how it should be, because that is how you generate heat. In terms of an IC champion, it's undeniable that Randy Savage is one of the three best ones ever, and that counts from all the way from 79 up to the current day, quite frankly, because there are a couple of ways you can treat the Intercontinental title. You can treat it as this guy is the B-show headliner, which is what you'd like to do ideally if you are running multiple shows on a nightly basis like they were doing. And you could see that Savage was ready for that sort of thing. You have a guy like Honky Tonk Man who would go ahead and headline the B-shows in mid to late 1987 and do a pretty good job of it. And that's how he was a good champion. But the true great Intercontinental champions also will use this as a stepping stone to something bigger and become a success on that level. Sometimes it doesn't work, like with the Ultimate Warrior being a very notable example, or even Mr. Perfect, who never got to that level for a variety of reasons, owing to, you know, mainly his back injury in 1991. But Randy Savage did get to that next level, of course, winning the tournament at WrestleMania 4. So he has this long run of nearly 14 months with the Intercontinental title, and then eventually goes through his, what I like to call, his most interesting man in the world phase in 1987, as he gradually becomes a babyface without one explicit moment on television, and then is a world champion for a full year in Hulk Hogan's WWF.
Look at it. What's he doing now, Jets? Look at Savage going down into his tights. He's got something in his hand. He missed it. He missed with it. Oh, look at this. Oh, he didn't miss that time. He drove that right into Santana's. We got a new champion. I can't believe it. We got a new Intercontinental Champion, Monsoon. Look at that. He just threw it outside the ring, Jess.
It's truly a fitting end for Tito Santana's second Intercontinental title reign, because it was his first reign that started in early 1984 in the Boston Garden against the Magnificent Morocco, a match that you can see small clips of on some of the TVs of the time period. They do play a clip announcing that Tito had won the title, but the match is not available in its entirety because the Garden shows on NESN, the New England Sports Network, were not shown until 1985. The first one featured Gorilla Monsoon and Mean Gene Okerlund on commentary, a duo that I don't particularly care for in this house show environment, especially when you can have Jesse in a very rare spot like he is on this February of 86 show, which is main evented by Piper and Bruno in a cage. So if that's enough for you to go check it out on the network. Last show televised was in June of 1989 when they were pretty much wrapping up televising any house shows outside of Madison Square Garden. And that show is most famous, maybe, I think, for Dusty Rhodes making a very early appearance in the WWF, subbing for Jake Roberts and taking on the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase, sans polka dots.
The arrival on the scene, brother of Terry Funk, Dory Funk Jr., now part of your family.
You know, our motto, Terry Funk and Jimmy Hart's motto, you know what it is? We don't get mad, we just get even. You know, we don't get mad, we just get even. You know, I was humiliated, and it made me so hot, but he said, don't get mad, we'll get even. That's right. And he lost the world championship because of the Junkyard Dog. But we didn't get mad, but we got even, didn't we, Terry?
All right. Gene Okerlund is with Jimmy Hart and Terry Funk. And no word if Okerlund got 40 lashes for using the word junior in reference to Dory Funk. But Terry is there, and he puts over his brother, whose main weakness as a performer is a promo. He's a little bit understated, particularly for the time period. It's something that would have worked in an earlier era, but you know, Dory Funk, again, in the mid-80s, it's a little strange of a fit. I do, as I said, I like seeing him there, but Terry puts him over in a way better than Dory ever could himself.
You see, because my brother might have eyes as cold as steel, and he might have a heart as cold as butane, but he does love me. And when a Junkyard Dog came at me with my own branding iron, my brother was there, because we're family. Now, the Junkyard Dog wants to talk about family and brothers. Well, let me tell you something. Don't trust this man. I know from past experiences that he'll slap you on the back with one hand and pick your pocket with the other. That's how he got so much gold around his neck, whip eye. And that's why he tried to pants my manager on national television, is to make a name out of himself, whip eye. And that's why he tried to cost me the world championship, and did cost me the world championship, whip eye. And it's not going to happen again, because he's not going to have the opportunity. Because remember, my brother loves me, and I've got a 157-pound wimp at ringside me that has already embarrassed you and humiliated you more than you've ever been humiliated before. But if you want me, just call. Let me hear you call, Junkyard Dog. Oh, dog, call me, because I'll always be there.
It's a lot of good stuff there to try and unpack, but my favorite thing was when he called Jimmy Hart a 157-pound wimp. Just throwing that out there. I actually doubt that Jimmy Hart weighed 157 pounds, but it reminded me of later when Bobby Heenan would talk about the Red Rooster or the Brooklyn Brawler in very disparaging terms in front of them. I always found that kind of amusing. Great stuff, as always, from the greatest of all time, Terry Funk. And as we get close to wrapping this up, they go to a commercial break, and you're going to be shocked by this, that there's an ad for Old Spice deodorant. Again, people in the 80s, very concerned about how they smelled. Might have something to do with a lot more smokers back then. That might be part of it. Then there's an ad for Outdoor Life magazine, something to do with the most dangerous game, which I always thought was man, but apparently they're referring to animals. And then a 30-second spot in support of the original wrestling album from November of 1985.
When over 10,000 pounds of beef comes roaring at you, it can mean only one thing. The wrestling album with Hulk Hogan's theme, A Real American. Hillbilly Jim's Don't Go Messing With A Country Boy, Don't Mess With A Country Boy. Plus performances by Roddy Piper, Nikolai Volkoff, Captain Lou, Jimmy Hart, Mean Gene, and the Junkyard Dog. Grab a copy of the wrestling album on Epic Records and Tapes, available at your record store.
When they go back after the promotional consideration, which was Halls, Cough Drops, Chunky Soup, Lifesavers, and Liquid Plumber, Gene runs down the tracks on the wrestling album. He actually finds a banana on the vinyl record, so he makes a crack that Gorilla must have been around. He actually combines the track Hulk Hogan's theme with Real American, almost to kind of make you think that the two are one and the same, but they are most definitely not. Hulk Hogan's theme is its own thing, as I went into in episode 17, where he came to the ring to that song before he had adopted Real American. He puts over Tutti Frutti, and he kind of forgot to do that as his own track on the album to win an award at the upcoming Slammies. And that's how he closes out for WWF All-American Wrestling for February 23rd, 1991. It's no YouTube comment theater this week because there's only like three comments, and one of them is like a guy just pointing out various timestamps with absolutely no reason for any of it. And time for the quick podcast roundup. And this is not for greedy hucksters who already have money behind their podcast and are touring nationwide, who have thrown themselves on Patreon anyway. I mean, what are they going to do? Sell, you know, body hair to those who sign up for the $28 a month tier? Jesus. On the Our Vantage Point podcast, they go over the best and worst of referees in wrestling. Sure, that's a very interesting discussion and a topic near and dear to my heart. Also near and dear to the heart of referee Mike Crockett of the wrestling podcast About Nothing. Alongside Brian Malonis, they had on Ace Romero of CZW. And all the stuff on the Pro Wrestling Only feed this week, WorldCast, and a podcast that dropped on Monday with the Hales brothers talking about the first half of 2018 in the WWF. As I record this, I have to check that out because I need to get back up to date, because when I put on the network the other day, on Sunday, I was very confused because I saw Extreme Rules on there and it didn't identify what year it was. I was like, is Extreme Rules actually tonight? And then I quickly had to check and realize that no, it is actually next Sunday, or this coming Sunday from Pittsburgh. And coming up next week on this show, I'm going to be taking a look at an interesting WCW show that is somewhat localized, WCW Pro on WGN, the station in Chicago. Since I'm going to Chicago a couple of days, actually, I'm flying out the day that that show drops. And this edition is from March 9th, 1991. And on this show, the Fabulous Freebirds do the unthinkable and execute a short sell of the tag team titles. More on that as I get into it. And Missy Hyatt goes on a date with a... Missy Hyatt goes on a date with Elegante. Comedy ensues, I can assure you. So check that out next Thursday. Greetings from Allentown, either on my own feed or on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Thank you so much for listening, and continue to spread the word about Greetings from Allentown. A 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music is certainly appreciated. And tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown. I'm ready.
World Wrestling Federation has caused a culture shock in every phase of our society, from classical to rock. In triumphant jubilation, every social class is one with a single common interest, just to have a little fun. I've seen the rapture in the eyes of fans from every nation. You made us what we are today, World Wrestling Federation.
What disgusting music!